First case on our calendar, 03-899, State of Ohio versus Christina Moody. Mr. Whitesell.
Thank you, Your Honor. I believe the issue of what constitutes strict liability is an issue that still needs some resolution, given the various cases of this court and lower courts over the years. We're here to argue today that Revised Code Section 2919.24A1 does impose strict liability, and every district appellate court in Ohio that has decided this issue, except for the Second District, has decided that it is, and we believe that those other districts are correct in their decision.
Counsel, there's the old adage, bad facts make bad law. Aren't these just horrible facts to apply strict liability to?
It would not have been the case I would have chosen, but it's the case that we were given. And it's not so much that the facts were bad.
What do you mean, the case that you were given?
Well,
You're the prosecutor's office, aren't you?
Well, the facts were better than they appear on the record. We had a prosecutor at the time who was a novice and did not develop the record as well as she should have.
But now we're stuck with that.
That is correct, but the principles are what we're arguing here, because ultimately, no matter what you decide, will have no effect on the outcome of the case since there was an acquittal. There were, however, two pronouncements by the court, one of which is before the court today, which were statements of law that we would not want to just go into future cases having that continue to be the law, especially since the Second District, as well as that judge, made that decision.
So if Jimmy's parents, and Jimmy's in high school and 18 years old, and he has a 17-year-old classmate, and wants to invite him over overnight, and Jimmy's parents say that's fine, and his friend says that it's fine with mom and dad, they're going to have to call mom and dad and make sure it's fine.
I would say that would normally be the case. I think most parents would do that anyway. I don't think they want to have somebody in their home that they don't know their parents know where they are, whether they've explicitly given that permission or not. They're at least going to make sure that the other person's parents, the other kid's parents, know where that child is.
And I have
then give those parents an opportunity. I'm sorry.
I have teenage boys, and this case, I thought, my God, if this is the standard for strict liability, I am in deep trouble, because I have kids stay overnight all the time, and you rely on them saying, you know, they're kids you've known for ages, you rely on them saying their parents said it was okay, and here you even have a cousin, a relative, and to say that, I mean, I guess the problem I have with your saying strict liability in an area where there is so much variation, usually strict liability, you know you did it, you know you're within so many feet of a school or whatever, but here you have this amorphous area of parental responsibility, and to say that it's strict liability when there's shades of gray all over the place, if you've been a recent parent or a parent at all, I think that's maybe why the legislature didn't put in language requiring strict liability. Because it's such an amorphous area, you're right, Justice Piper's right, these are horrible facts to make this case on.
I believe, however, that the general rule that children are to be protected is supported by structure of the law in which these cases
I don't disagree with you, absolutely, but to put strict liability on a parent for areas of gray that extend all over the map makes it extremely difficult to set a standard for. And isn't that why maybe the legislature put the standard of reckless in and saying if we don't say strict liability, then you look at reckless?
No, I don't believe that the legislature specifically said it was reckless. I think that's why we're here today, that it's not clear. But I believe that's why we have the other element of the law that we look to see whether a person did or did not take an act or a refrain from an act. But I think also part of that definition has to be, is there the opportunity or the capability of taking such an act? You're going
to
be looking at the
circumstances. So under your test, anything that under ordinary, say, tort law would be a negligence standard converts into strict liability under your test. If you're just negligent in supervising a child, under your test, though, you're strictly liable, correct?
if it's possible to make some action. I mean, there are cases where they make that distinction, such as in excessive punishment. Clearly, the law is written in such a way that it implies that there has to be a higher standard than strict liability because there's a subjective element to it as opposed to an objective test you can apply to making that decision. I think maybe the best example I can give is something that's not directly involved in strict liability, but a few years ago, I believe this court investigated dram shop activities. I haven't cited any cases on this, but I just ran across it one day and I thought there's a parallel here. This court had to decide what knowingly meant in the context of a commercial dram shop serving intoxicating beverages in two different circumstances. One of which was where they had to decide that they were serving them to a person who was already too intoxicated, in another case, serving them to a minor. The court defined knowingly rather strictly in the case of the individual who is intoxicated, saying it has to be actual knowledge. That's because it was difficult. It's a subjective view as to whether or not somebody has been too drunk. On the other hand, whether somebody is or isn't a minor is something that can be objectively determined. And the dram shop operator was at least alleged to not have made that determination. They didn't look at the facts of the situation. We're suggesting that the statutory scheme of things is such that this statute is intended to protect children as a group and a body, and that the strict liability would apply if there is a situation where there is an objective manner in making that determination.
Yeah, well, I think the trouble comes in when you want to apply that to adults for contributing to the unruliness. Contributing to the delinquency, that's a little easier to figure out. And certainly easier for the adult to understand when they might be doing that. But unruliness is a catch-all used to deal with all kinds of problems with children, from truancy, as this case is, to lots of other things where they just don't fit in, but they're out of control, and as far as the parents are concerned, or as far as the court is concerned, I'm not going to let you off that easily on how this case got here. You or your office decided to appeal. This is one little unruly case in your county, and you decided to take it to the Court of Appeals. Now, what prompted that decision?
It was the simple ruling by the court that said, in essence, that this is not strict liability. We believed, looking at all the cases and the laws, that was an incorrect ruling.
Yeah, but you got horrible facts, and I mean, almost 18-year-old boy, and the problem is he's skipping school a little.
Well, he's almost 18, but these people knew his age. The statement that it was a cousin by marriage, I don't know how well known they assumed that this individual was, but it was not something that we believe under the circumstances. From our own knowledge of the case, which I know you don't have in the record, I know it could have been presented better, but having this before that court, they made two decisions, one of which we specifically appealed because we believe it was so against what the entire state was saying, contrary to what our district had said in one case. And our district, of course, followed its own precedent, but all the other precedents are contrary, and I believe most of the courts have agreed that the reason for that was that they believed it was protecting children. And I believe the statutory scheme suggests that. First of all, because even though this statute now appears, as other counsel has stated, in Title 29, these cases are always exclusively under the jurisdiction of the juvenile court, which suggests to me that the purpose is for the court to see what's in the best interest of the child under those circumstances when making their decisions.
Why didn't you charge the mother? I mean, her son took off and stayed somewhere, and she never called him.
Apparently, she had made efforts to find this child several times. And it wasn't because she was neglecting the child. She couldn't find him. And she made efforts, and she did, in fact, call the police to try to locate.
Okay, so she was just negligent, and so it's therefore she's not strictly liable in not keeping him under control?
Because she had the options, she had the opportunity to take what action she could, and as one other case, I believe it was actually the second district in State versus Michael, where somebody has made a clear effort to comply, there's not going to be that application, even though it's a strict liability, they're going to be found not guilty or not subject to liability because of the other statute, which says that you must commit an act or fail to commit an act. Here, she did not fail to commit an act to protect her child. She went looking for him. She made the effort, and therefore it would have been difficult to convict her under the other statute that goes beyond that next step.
So if the woman had said to the kid, did you call your mother, and the kid had lied and said yes,
I think if she could convince the court that she made the effort, some effort, there might be at least an issue for a judge to determine whether or not that is sufficient effort to get past the strict liability issue. So I think there can be, if we're just looking in generally, the rules of how about going about strict liability. I believe there are some things that are common to all cases. The last unanimous opinion from this court was 1997 on an opinion. There have been a couple of unanimous judgments, but no opinions, and that was State versus Schlosser. And I believe the series of statements in that case provide a foundation for a more a rule by which one can make certain determinations. And I think if the court would return to some of the statements in that and combine it with what I believe is a very well-reasoned opinion in State versus Bowersmith from the Third District, there would be a clearer way of making a determination for the lower courts. Reading the cases of the lower courts, I find that, in my opinion, they're struggling with how to apply this on a case-by-case basis. And I think some more specific guidelines would be appropriate from this court on how to make those decisions. And I think one of the things that's in common in all of the cases, stretching all the way back, not just recent years, is there's some element of the mala prohibita. There is at least some element somewhere, even if it is used those terms, of protecting the public or some segment of the public from harm, that there's a protected group or protected class or a danger involved. And that the other issue that comes up is that there is the capability of acting or not acting in some manner. And all of this can be seen within the statutory schemes. And I believe it's some direction combining the elements of Schlosser with Bowersmith might help give some guidance. And frankly, I think we're a little more concerned with that than the particular outcome of the case, although we do believe that strict liability was intended for this statute, always providing that we have the protections of demonstrating that there was an act or an omission to act that could have been taken by some party.
Well, what is the rule that you want us to write in this case then, Mr. Whitesell?
I believe basically just going back to readopt, I don't know if I can say it very succinctly.
Well, your proposition talks about the facts and circumstances should be interpreted, and that talk about asking us for a specific rule. You put the vague, wide open language in your proposition.
I think I would have, you know, reconsidered that after looking at some more of the cases. I believe there needs to be something.
But what is the specific rule you're looking for?
Something that along the lines that the mala prohibita, that you look in the language that is under Schlosser concerning the mala prohibita rules, I think, and then looking at the rules and the guidance that are in Bowersmith. I can't come up with an exact word right now, and I would like to reserve the last 30 seconds if possible for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Whitesell.
Thank you.
Mr. Slicer.
Thank you.
Good morning. First of all, I'd like to start out with a kind of a time frame. The state argues that this statute under 2919.24, this contributing statute, is a strict liability statute. It's my position and our position that this statute is not a strict liability statute. In his brief to this court, he notes some prior case law. In particular, I believe he cites State v. Cole. In that case, it indicates that this statute is a strict liability statute. Timeline, looking at this, in 1974, I revised code section 2901.21 went into effect. That statute indicates that if the statute does not indicate any criminal culpability or does not indicate any type of strict liability, reckless is to be the standard.
So the Cole case predated the complete revision of the criminal code?
The Cole case predated 2919.24, which was enacted in 1986. So the Cole case came in after that, but when this statute was enacted in the criminal section instead of the juvenile section was repealed, and then this went into effect. And the General Assembly did not put any language in that particular section stating that any part of that was strict liability. Then, you know, if you look back at 2901.21, then you fall back on the reckless standard, which becomes a standard of culpability under that statute. And I think if we look at other statutes and compare that, for instance, a higher revised code 151317B, that was enacted after 1986. And in that provision, in one of those provisions, specifically states, no person shall, but then it goes on to impose a strict liability standard, which would seem to me and seem to us that the General Assembly at that point knew of the strict liability, put it in at least this section, but did not put it in section 2919.24, which is an issue today. Other statutes which indicate strict liability is a high revised code 4303.202B, which also sets out strict liability and specifically states that. Also look at a high revised code 1329.29D, which again sets out strict liability. It's not silent, but it does indicate along the lines of strict liability, which comes in after the 1986, even the enactment of the juvenile code or the criminal code.
What was that code section?
1329.29D.
So that's in the commerce?
Yeah, they're not any criminal, but what I'm trying to do is just by comparison say the General Assembly knew or put specific language in strict liability in other sections, but they omitted it from this. I'm just trying to compare the two of them.
So basically what you're saying is they knew how to write a strict liability statute, and if they didn't write a strict liability statute, we're supposed to apply reckless. Is that basically what
exactly.
You're saying?
Exactly. And then the state points to the State v. Schlossinger, State v. Maxwell, and State v. WAC, W-A-C. I'm going to apologize if I'm mispronouncing that. In those cases, if you note, the strict liability or even the culpability in those statutes in one part, I believe in Schlossinger it indicates a knowingly section in one section, but nothing in the other provisions of that statute. So this court came in and said, must be strict liability in the other parts of the statute since it was admitted. What I'm trying to do is compare this to the statute we're here today and say there's nothing in that statute in its entirety, the 2919.24, there's no culpability. And if you go back to 2901.21, it says in that, and again in that statute, says if there's nothing to indicate any culpability in the statute, then you fall back to the reckless standard. The state also argues public policy of minors, in stating that this statute has to be a strict liability because it's supposed to protect minors. There's several cases this court has looked at in regards to that, decided that in dealing with children's issues, it's not a strict liability. State v. Collins dealt with child support, failure to support dependents. The state looked at that and said, there's nothing in to indicate that there's a strict liability, reckless is the standard. State v. O'Brien was a child endangerment. Again, we're dealing with a case with kids again. This court looked at that and said, there's no culpability in the statute, no strict liability, and therefore this is the reckless standard under the 2901. State v. Young dealt with possession of oriented nudity of minor children. Again, children, we're dealing with children again, and this court looked at it instead. No strict liability standard, no culpability stated in the statute, Therefore, we're going to go back to 2901 and impose a reckless standard. And again, in State v. McGee and State v. Adams, child endangerment. Nothing in the statute, this court imposed a reckless standard, not imposed strict liability. And then there's other statutes, State v. Parrish, State v. Jordan. This court reviewed those to see if there was a standard of strict liability. The court said there's no culpability in the statute. Therefore, we look back to 2901.21, enacted in 1974, which says if there's nothing indicate culpability, nor does it state anything regarding strict liability, we apply a reckless standard. In their brief from the state, they argue that 2919.24 is ambiguous. They argue that it needs to be clarified, needs to be defined more, and strict liability applied. We propose that there's no ambiguity about this statute. When you read this statute, 2919.24, in conjunction with 2901.21, it's clear that the General Assembly left out the culpability standard, and therefore we fall back to the reckless standard. And Justice Pfeiffer and Justice Stratton, I agree with you. If we apply a strict liability, I have kids too, if we apply a strict liability standard to this statute, we're going to have absurd results.
But we should not, we really, this is strictly, you, so far your argument's been, I think, right on the mark because you've confined it to a legal argument, which this is. We're not concerned here about the facts, are we, of the case?
No, I agree.
This is strictly a legal argument. Whether the General Assembly has said it's strict liability, it hasn't, and that we have these principles that we apply to determine whether we say it's going to be strict liability because the General Assembly really intended for it to be. That's the issue, is it not?
Yes, that is.
We can have very egregious factual situations that would cause us to think, well, if we apply the facts here, if we apply the law to the facts, we might want strict liability. But that's not really the issue, is it?
No, I agree with you. It's the legal issue.
Does the fact that the word shall is used make any difference?
Not my opinion. If we take a look at Title 29, the Ohio Revised Code, almost every statute begins with no person shall. Mm-hmm. And so if we apply the strict liability to every statute that says no person shall, then we're going to deal with the criminal code in its entirety and say everything's strict liability.
Because I agree with you. That is a basic, an elementary principle that when a culpability standard is not stated, we've always held that then it's recklessness.
True, correct.
And even in statutes that say shall.
That's correct. And there's many statutes that do say no person shall and indicates no culpability. And courts have said we apply the reckless standard under 2901. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Slicer. Mr. Whitesell, you've saved about a half a minute of your time.
Sure. Your Honors, on the last issue, no person shall, I think we indicated that we did not believe also that the mere stating of that it would be sufficient to find strict liability. What we're pointing out is that many courts, including this court and sometimes in the past, and many lower courts have tried to use that. And I think one of the reasons they've tried to use that is because they weren't finding another way to go about making the decision that they believed was correct under the circumstances. That's why I believe they need some other form of guidance to fall back on. And that's, I believe I've run out of time.
Thank you.
Thank you.